The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Free Library. My name is David Strawbridge. I am a member of the library's Pepper Society, and it's my distinct pleasure this evening to be able to welcome Jeffrey Toobin to Philadelphia. You may hear that he is, in part, a native of Philadelphia to the extent that his parents grew up in Strawberry Mansion. Before we get started, let me remind you of one of the most essential rules, and that is all of you who do or may believe that you have your cell phones on, kindly turn them off. We want to hear those little bings and twings of the cell phones going off now as opposed to during the presentation. However, if someone has a webcast and without any noise whatsoever they can get a Philly score, I'm sitting right here in the front row. I wanted to save that immediately before we introduce Mr. Toobin, who suffers from the deficiency of being a Mets fan. I called my son about 2 minutes ago, who's at the game, and did get the score, and learned, quite importantly, that the Mets already have two errors before there was one out in the first inning. So we might expect Mr. Toobin to answer for that. Mr. Toobin did not intend to become a journalist. Both of his parents had worked in television journalism, but as a young man, he claimed to be entirely sure that he did not want to follow in their footsteps. He then decided to pursue a degree in law and graduated from Harvard in 1986 and, upon admission to the New York State Bar, began his legal career with Special Prosecutor Lawrence Welsh in the ultimate prosecution of Oliver North in the Iran-Contra affair. This experience inspired Jeffrey to author his first book, Opening Arguments, in which he took readers behind the scenes of this major criminal case and shared the story of his personal and professional education in our nation's capital. He then continued his chosen path with a 3-year stint as an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of New York, dealing with a lot of drug prosecutions coming through the JFK airport. But as he reported in an interview by Publishers Weekly in the year 2000, he said it was almost like a light bulb going off. He had to confront what mattered to him most, and he thought to himself, I really like writing more than law or politics, and maybe there really is nothing wrong with doing what your parents did. We should all have children like that. In 1993, Mr. Toobin began his ongoing work as a staff writer for The New Yorker, which is a way in which many of us perhaps first became introduced to him. He has since published several best-selling books, including The Run for His Life, The People of California versus O.J. Simpson, Too Close to Call, The 36-Day Battle to Decide the 2000 Election. In addition to his achievements as an author and print journalist, Mr. Toobin is also an Emmy Award-winning TV journalist serving as a senior legal analyst, as I'm sure you know, for CNN Worldwide. This most recent book, The Nine, is not about baseball. It is rather about what is perhaps the single most important legal body in this country, the United States Supreme Court. And it reveals in a wonderful graphic way the complex dynamic among those nine individuals who currently serve on that court and who in very recent history did serve in that court. We are doubly honored tonight not just to have Mr. Toobin here, but also to have our own Marty Moskowain, host of Radio Times on WHYY, who will conduct the interview of Mr. Toobin. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming to the Free Library Jeffrey Toobin and Marty Moskowain.
Great to have such a full house.
Wow, it's great.
You You'd be happy.
It was ugly. I thought the whole Mets thing. I just, you know.
We can work this in. Just a couple of little announcements. We are taping this interview for broadcast on Radio Times, and it will be on that program Monday, October 8th at 10 o'clock in the morning, just so you know. And Jeffrey Toobin's book will be number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list this Sunday. So congratulations.
Good.
This is actually one of several books that have come out this year about the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you think the court is more open to scrutiny, that it's allowing journalists like yourself to come and ask questions?
Well, I wouldn't overstate how welcoming they were to me. Yes, I was able to do the reporting, but it is not an easy place to report, and I don't pretend that I had access to every justice. But I think the court was very traumatized by the publication of The Brethren in 1979. That book opened up an entire new subject in the field of journalism, and people knew nothing about it. And if you recall anything about Bob Woodward and Scott Armstrong's book, it was basically about how they all hated Warren Berger. And they were, I think, traumatized, and the court shrunk from public scrutiny for quite some time. And that book, you know, it's 1979, it's a long time ago. And I think, you know, the court has turned over almost completely, except for Justice Stevens, since then. And I think they recognize that they need to have the public's respect, and one way to get it is open up to a little more scrutiny.
But do you think the degree of secrecy, as you say, even mystery about the court, is good for a democracy?
Well, as a journalist, I'm temperamentally ill-disposed toward secrecy as any sort of positive impact. I mean, I don't think the justices' conferences should be televised.
You know, don't?
No. But certainly I think their oral arguments should be televised. I think it's it's the public's business, and it's high. It's of enormous importance. I think, actually, if people saw the oral arguments, it would reflect well on the court, because this particular moment in history is a time when 8 of the justices ask lots of really difficult, hard questions,
and one does not.
One does not. In fact.
Has he ever asked a question?
Well, no. See, Justice Thomas surpassed even his own record this year, because from October to April, through more than 100 arguments, he did not ask a single question, did not speak. And one of the enterprising reporters, I believe from McClatchy Newspapers, counted up the words that each justice spoke during oral arguments, and Stephen Breyer came in first with 35,000, and Justice Thomas was zero. Yeah.
But what do you make of that? I mean, the fact that he does not speak from the bench.
This is a question he is asked all the time when he speaks, which he does speak at colleges and universities. Only certain kinds of colleges and universities. As he said to someone, I don't do Ivies. And in fairness, he does do smaller universities that don't get Supreme Court justices, but he does a lot of conservative evangelical schools which are temperamentally suited towards him. But he's still asked why he doesn't. And he gives various answers. One of the most bizarre answers he's given is that he grew up speaking Gullah, which is a language on the south coast of Georgia, and was uncomfortable speaking English at first. But, I mean, that's just not true. Mm. I mean, he grew up mostly in Savannah, where he was an excellent student in a parochial school where he spoke English flawlessly, as he continues to today. He says he thinks the other justices talk too much, which is a reasonable argument. He thinks the lawyers deserve not to be interrupted, which is reasonable. My own theory is, because so much attention has been focused on the fact that he doesn't speak in oral argument, that focused by people like journalists whom he despises, that he'll be damned if he's going to give us the satisfaction of starting to talk now.
So he's just going to show you,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. No, I'm not kidding. I think that's the real reason.
Well, you know, just to follow up and to talk a bit more about Justice Thomas, Jan Crawford Greenberg also has written a book about the Supreme Court, and her assessment of Thomas is that he's actually much more influential on Antonin Scalia than the other way around, which I think was the perception of the relationship between the two. How do you see him.
Well, I agree that Thomas and Scalia are very different jurisprudentially. And I think Thomas was unfairly criticized as sort of a Scalia clone in his early years. I think Thomas has very little influence on the court when you examine what he actually writes in his opinions. He is not the most conservative member of this court. He is the most conservative member of this court since the 1930s. He has said very clearly, particularly in a case called the United States versus Lopez in 1994, that he basically believes the New Deal is unconstitutional, that the justices who were replaced during the court packing plan, the fight that was had during the 1930s, that Franklin Roosevelt tried to have replaced, the Four Horsemen, as they were called, he basically agrees with their view of the Constitution. And unlike his fellow justices, he does not believe in great deference to precedent. As he has said often, he says if a decision's wrong, he's happy to overrule it tomorrow. And he thinks a lot of them are wrong.
Interestingly, and I do want to talk about some of the other justices, he's often found at NASCAR races.
He is. Well, he... one of the great life-changing events about 8 or 9 years ago, his great-nephew, who was then, I guess, about 5 years old, there was a great deal of family trouble. People were arrested. Some went to jail. And Thomas and his wife, Virginia, adopted this boy. And right around the time, Clarence Thomas was adopted by his grandfather. And this has brought Clarence Thomas great joy. And one of the things they do with this child is they have bought this enormous RV, which he calls the bus. And they just take off in it on weekends and park it in Walmart parking lots overnight. Which, as I think a crowd like this probably would not know, Walmart has a policy of allowing RVs to stay in their parking lots overnight. And that's what they do, and go to NASCAR races.
You also say that he knows all the guards, that he's really very sort of beloved of many of the people that work at the court.
This is why I find Thomas such an interesting figure, because, I mean, there is obviously a tremendous rage at his pursuers to this day. For many years, he kept in his desk the roll call of the 52 senators who voted for his confirmation and the 48 against him, and it was mostly for the 48. You know, he had a, I believe it said Yale sucks bumper sticker up in his chambers because he thought Yale Law School sided with Anita Hill, not with him. Yet at the same time, he is really a beloved figure. You know, yes, it is true that he doesn't speak in oral arguments. But if you go to the court, you often see he sits next to Stephen Breyer. They pass notes. They tell jokes. They laugh. I mean, he is not an isolated figure at the court. He is very much a beloved individual.
And what does he think about NPR's Nina Totenberg?
Well, one of the more bizarre scenes in The Nine is he spoke at this really sort of low-rent, Clinton-hating fundraiser in 1999, I think it was, where they were given sort of fake awards to journalists they thought were left-wing, and they gave it to Brian Gumbel, and they gave it... And Thomas talked about Nina Totenberg, basically about how much, you know, she'd stuck knives into him, and, you know, he'd love to give back to her. I mean, it was really so wildly... inappropriate, I thought. And if you, the way the Supreme Court chamber works is the Chief Justice sits in the middle and they sit alternating on the basis of seniority. And the court was together for 11 years. The seating arrangement didn't change. And Thomas, much to his pleasure, was all the way on the right side because that's the farthest from where the press sits. But now that Alito came in. Thomas is now back on the left, where Nina Totenberg always sits right in the front. And he sort of, I was noticing this in June when, it's really pretty close. I mean, it's probably about as close as I am to the front row. And Thomas leans back, so Stephen Breyer blocks his view of Nina Totenberg.
inside the secret Supreme Court, right?
Yeah. Well, no, you can see it yourself.
Well, let me shift gears because you spent a lot of time, interestingly, in this book on the 2000 race, Bush v. Gore, and just quoting something here. You write, Jeffrey, the justices displayed all their worst traits in this decision, among them vanity, overconfidence, impatience, arrogance, and simple political partisanship. These 3 weeks taint an otherwise largely admirable legacy. The justices did almost everything wrong. They embarrassed themselves and the Supreme Court. Pretty strong
words. But other than that, it was
words.
An excellent job by the... the spelling and the opinion was excellent.
Why did they take this case?
Well, that passage has been quoted back, and I knew it would
be. Well, those
are
strong words.
Well, you know, I the book is not terribly opinionated, and it is not. No,
except
it really,
for those
except
words.
For that part. I mean, I'm sorry, I couldn't restrain myself about Bush v. Gore. The book is not a polemic. It is not an argument that the Supreme Court should do X rather than Y. But I do think Bush v. Gore was a real black mark for this court, and I think the problem, as I write elsewhere, was not that it led to Bush's election as opposed to Gore's election, because I think it is fair to say if the court had ruled otherwise, it is not clear who would have won the election. But the best you can hope for an appeals court, I think. Is I don't believe that politics can never be a part of it, but I do think a certain measure of ideological consistency is and a recognition that the rules that apply to one person apply to everybody. And what that decision looked like was a court that in other circumstances embraced the federalism and states' rights, and in other circumstances interpreted the Equal Protection Clause very narrowly when it comes to, for example, the rights of black people and women, all of a sudden decided to inject itself into a state presidential race and find that George W. Bush was the victim of an equal protection violation that just seemed wildly inconsistent with their prior views.
Were they surprised about the reaction? Of course, it was a mixed reaction, but there was a lot of criticism to this day of this decision.
Yes. I think it is safe to say, I mean, the justices are used to being criticized, and I think have a pretty thick skin about that. But the level of animosity about Bush v. Gore was something that shocked them. And one of the things in the nine that surprised me the most was the legacy of Bush v. Gore, which was very different from what I expected it would be.
And what did you see as the legacy?
Well, I think it affected two people the most, Anthony Kennedy and Sandra O'Connor. Anthony Kennedy has a very elevated idea of the position of the judge, of someone who's a lawgiver. Some have called him rather pretentious on the subject. But he really did not like being criticized as a political hack, which was what the description that many people had for the majority. And he, after the 2000 election, deepened his commitment to international law and international travel. He was fascinating. In 1987, he was appointed to the Supreme Court at the age of 50, still lived in the house in Sacramento where he grew up. That's how provincial he appeared. Yet he spent all this time abroad as a Supreme Court justice, and on spending time with foreign judges was particularly influenced on the death penalty and gay rights and moved to the left,
But you think that's a reaction to to this decision?
I think it was. And even more profound and even more significant was Sandra O'Connor's reaction, because Sandra O'Connor is the only former elected official who was on the court. She was a state senator from Arizona, a proud Republican, and someone who came, it turned out, from a very different political tradition than George W. Bush came to reflect. She thought that George W. Bush was going to be much like his father, kind of a country club Republican, which is basically what she was. She saw that George W. Bush turned into a movement conservative. And the appointment of John Ashcroft, the reaction in terms of civil liberties to 9/11, the war in Iraq, the Terri Schiavo case, which affected her deeply, alienated her from the Bush administration in a very profound way and moved her considerably to the left during her last term. Now, this led to a personal... I'm sorry to ramble here.
No, no, go ahead.
This personal drama where, as she became more alienated from President Bush, her husband was slipping into the grip of Alzheimer's disease, and she came to recognize that she had to leave the court, she thought, to take care of him, even though at age 75 was at the peak of her power and influence, and did leave the court in 2005. But her extended leave-taking, remember, Roberts was first nominated, then Rehnquist died, Roberts was nominated for chief, Harriet Myers was nominated for her seat, then finally Alito. During all those months, nearly a year, her husband really slipped beyond her help. So she wound up losing both her beloved job and her beloved husband at exactly the same time.
This goes back a bit, and it's a bit gossipy, but much has been said about a comment that she made as the returns were coming in 2000. She was at a cocktail party, and she was quoted as saying, "This is terrible. That means it's over." And there was evidence that Gore was, I guess, pulling ahead. What do you make of those comments? And did she actually say them?
Well, yeah, because it's in the book.
Okay. Just checking. Just had to make sure.
Yeah. And she said them. And you know, I don't think I think it's a little indiscreet, but I don't think anyone should kid themselves that the Supreme Court justices don't vote or have preferences.
Right.
Supreme Court, in presidential elections, you don't get on the Supreme Court by being completely outside the political world. I mean, you know, it takes a lot of savvy and interest, and she was perhaps a little indiscreet, but I don't think anyone. Right. But I think what's interesting about that comment is what she thought George W. Bush was going to be, and what he became is something very different.
But what you're implying is that she and perhaps the others on the court that voted with her wanted George W. Bush to be president of the United States.
Well, you know, that is kind of the ultimate question about Bush v. Gore. You know, was it a simple partisan, awarding of the election to the one they wanted to win, or was it a more principled decision? You know, I am not enough of a scholar of the human heart to be able to say what they really, really were doing when they voted, but the tawdry and transparent way they conducted themselves certainly lent itself to an unkind analysis of their motives.
You describe Sandra Day O'Connor as the most important woman in American history, more important than Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, absolutely. Well, she wasn't anybody's wife. You know, she did it herself. I mean, the story of Sandra Day O'Connor is an extraordinary saga of, you know, this woman raised on a ranch on the Arizona-New Mexico border who, you know, makes her way to Stanford Law School, where she graduates near the very top of her class, valedictorian William Rehnquist, and the best job she's offered is as a legal secretary. I mean, that's the legal world into which she arrived. She arrives on the Supreme Court in 1981, not even from the highest court in Arizona, from the Intermediate Appeals Court in Arizona, thrust into, you know, a world with, you know, William Brennan and really legendary figures. And on issue after issue, 25 years later, the court's rules are her rules. And, you know, that's amazing.
Did she talk to you for this book?
I can't say. I'm not saying about which justices I talked to.
Okay, I was thinking I would sneak that in there.
Yes.
Now, Kennedy is the new O'Connor. He's been described as this swing vote on the court.
Well, I think even more than when O'Connor was on the court, this is a polarized court. You have four very conservative justices, Scalia, Thomas, Robertson, Alito. You have four moderate to liberal justices, Stevens, Souter, Breyer, and Ginsburg, and Kennedy in the middle. So even more than O'Connor, he's the swing vote. I mean, last term, there were 25 5-4 decisions. Mm-hmm. Anthony Kennedy was in the majority in every single one. That's power.
Does he swing? This seems weird to say this, but does he swing the way she does?
No, she's.
That sounded
really
bad.
Yeah, you got to buy the book to get to that part. No.
Boy, that really came out
right.
Really terribly.
The No, she doesn't. He swings differently. No, he's definitely more conservative than she is. And thus we saw in this last term a much more conservative court.
But you also call him intellectually incoherent.
He is.
This is Kennedy.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, Kennedy believes in writing these beautiful highfalutin phrases about, you know, the people's sense of themselves and about the mystery of the universe. And it's the kind of thing that drives several of his fellow justices crazy. I mean, Justice Scalia, for example, refers to, he has said on the record, you know, Justice Kennedy's notorious mysteries of life passage. I mean, you know, I think sometimes of what he writes sounds sort of poetic, but means very little.
Talk a bit about Justice Souter, because I think he's such an interesting person on this court.
I mean, you know,
a person who really lives off the grid.
He lives off the grid. He doesn't have a computer. He doesn't have a fax machine. He writes with a fountain pen. When he arrived at the court, he had never heard of Diet Coke. He was at a wedding in 2003 where someone made a reference to the Supremes, and he was unaware of that singing group. But, you know, smart, funny. If I can just tell one little Justice Souter story. Justice Souter, you know, one of the amazing things about the court is that people are not really familiar with the justices, what they look like. And there is a well-known fact at the court that Justice Souter and Justice Breyer are often mistaken for each other. And they don't really look alike. I mean, you know, sort of upper middle-aged white guys, but, you know, that's not really much like each other. But anyway, one time not too long ago, Justice Souter was driving, as he is wont to do, from Washington up to his home in New Hampshire. And he stopped to get something to eat, and a couple came up to him, and the man said, "You're on the Supreme Court, right?" And he said, "Yes." He says, "You're Stephen Breyer." And he didn't want to embarrass the guy in front of his wife, and so he said, "Yes, I'm Stephen Breyer." And they chatted for a little while, and so the guy said, "So Justice Breyer, what's the best thing about being on the Supreme Court?" And he thought for a minute. He said, "I guess it's the privilege of serving with David Souter."
That's great.
Now, how can you not love that,
that's
right?
Great.
I mean, that's pretty good. You know, Zoe doesn't have a fax machine. Big deal.
Yeah.
Right?
No, it's a great story. Yeah. He also has had the same lunch.
He has the same lunch every day. He has an apple and a cup of yogurt, including the core of the apple. It's horrible.
And did he threaten to, or at least contemplate, quitting the court after Bush v. Gore?
And this is where that personal eccentricity, I think, has a more substantive significance. You know, the Supreme Court justices, except for Souter, they circulate in Washington, they go to parties, they, you know, talk to senators, and, you know, they're part of Washington life. Souter is not at all. Does not go out. And I think has an almost mystical and 19th century attachment to the idea of being a judge and the need to respect precedent. And Bush v. Gore was such a trauma for him that he nearly resigned in protest from the court. And you know, that I talk about that in the book. And I think that's indicative of the sensitive soul that he is. And, you know, this sort of silly personal stuff is reflective of a larger sort of perhaps innocence that is not shared by his colleagues.
You even said he cried.
Yeah, I did say he cried, yes.
Right. Cried after that decision.
Well, later, not like that night.
Okay.
That I'm aware of.
Talk a little bit about Justice Ginsburg, because she seems like an almost invisible person on the court. I mean, she's tiny for one thing.
She is tiny. She is a very small person. And what's surprising about her lack of personal presence is that she is probably the only member of the court who would be in all the history books if she'd never even served on the court, because she was the Thurgood Marshall of the women's rights movement. You know, she was the legal architect of striking down many of the laws that had discriminated against women. And until Chief Justice Roberts joined the court, she had the most oral arguments before the justices of any of the colleagues. But she is a very shy person. Mm. She is famous on the court in conversation for long, awkward pauses. And this is particularly awkward for clerkship applicants who go to interview. And, of course, they're very nervous. And you know, Justice Ginsburg is comfortable with these pauses. But the clerkship applicants, you know, start babbling like morons because they're so nervous about these silences. But you know, she's the only justice who chooses to keep her chambers on the second floor of the court. And I think that's indicative of her remove from her colleagues. And I think this last term, when the court took so many dramatic moves to the right, was the first time she really asserted herself, unfortunately for her, in dissenting opinions, but in a really forceful, passionate way.
Well, let's talk about the current court, the Roberts Court, as we now call it. And you describe in your book this dramatic change that, I guess, between Roberts and Alito and the other conservatives there, that there's a revolution underway.
Well, there may be. I mean, it certainly is a big change. And, you know, John Roberts is as charming, as intelligent, as knowing in the ways of the court as anyone who has served in many years. And it's interesting, there is a patronizing notion that liberals have about Roberts, which is, he's so smart, he must be kind of a closet moderate. No, there are lots of conservatives who are really, really smart, and he is really, really conservative. There is no inner moderate waiting to get out with John Roberts. He is the real deal. And Samuel Alito doesn't have the same kind of charm, but is equally conservative. And we saw in opinion after opinion this term, when Kennedy very much sided with the four conservatives in 5-4 case after 5-4 case, you know, upholding the late-term abortion ban that the court in 2000, almost identical case, had reversed, you know, limiting the ability to sue to stop church-state violations. In perhaps the most significant case decided on the last term, striking down Seattle and Louisville's attempt to integrate schools, all but suggesting that the use of race in any context, whether affirmative action or school assignment or school admissions, is impermissible. I mean, this has the potential to be a very conservative court.
Do you see this court, I mean, if it stays constituted as it is, overturning Roe v. Wade?
No. Justice Kennedy is on record as in the case, he signed on to the majority in the Casey decision. I mean, it does seem likely that Roe will shrink in its significance, but I don't believe this court will, if a state simply said abortion is banned in Mississippi, South Dakota, whatever the state is that, you know, would like to do it, I don't think they'd approve that.
Right. And this notion of executive power, how does this court view executive power? And have they ruled on it? Is there a sense that you have about how they see the executive?
Well, this is an unusual court historically in terms of the background of the justices. This is the first court in history where all nine justices were judges previously. The court that decided Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, not one of the justices had been a judge previously, which is just sort of an interesting change. Another historical curiosity about this court, but significant, only Stephen Breyer has any background of any significance in the legislative branch of government. Breyer was an aide to Senator Kennedy and really, you know, learned the way of Congress. You know, historically, the Supreme Court had former senators, people who really were comfortable in Congress. This is a court with a lot of contempt for Congress. And Alito and Roberts, you know, both came out of the Reagan administration where this move to expand executive power really began. The one hesitation I would say that you know, this court is going to embrace executive power completely is that on the issue of Guantanamo, Kennedy has generally so far sided with the liberals. And the court is likely to have a Guantanamo case again this year. So I would really hesitate to predict how that's going to come out.
Talk to us a bit about Samuel Alito. He was in the federal court here in Philadelphia. More conservative than Roberts?
You know, I think it's really too early to tell.
Is it?
They're both really, really conservative. I'll tell you perhaps an appropriate story. You know, one of the traditions that the court used to have that was revived recently was that the junior justice holds a dinner, a formal dinner, in honor of the newest justice. And Stephen Breyer decided to revive this tradition at the beginning of last term to welcome Alito. And it was beautiful. You know, the court is really kind of a family, and they invited the widow of Thurgood Marshall and the widow of Potter Stewart. And you know, they all came and had a beautiful candlelight dinner. And at the climax of the dinner, Stephen Breyer rose to give a toast. And he said, you know, Sam, welcome. This is a wonderful occasion, but I have to warn you. You know, you see your colleagues around the table. They're all nice to you now. But, you know, they'll turn on you. And what you need in this town is a friend, a loyal friend. And at that moment, the door opened, and in came the Philly fanatic.
No.
And who came with his big baseball head, and he came and gave Alito a big hug, because as you know, Alito's a big Philly
fan. Yes, he is.
And you know, Breyer and his clerks had staged this very elaborate prank. But, you know, he's certainly the leading Philly fan on the court.
But interestingly, comparing him and Justice O'Connor on abortion, his ruling on Planned Parenthood.
Right. I mean, you know, there are abundant reasons why Alito is more conservative than O'Connor, and that's why the court is so different now. Rehnquist and Roberts are really not that different, at least in terms of their voting patterns. I think in aggressiveness they probably are different, but voting not that different. The defining opinion, or one of the defining opinions of O'Connor's career, was the Pennsylvania Casey decision, where she upheld Roe versus Wade, and they decided to strike down part of the Pennsylvania abortion law. The part of the abortion law that most offended O'Connor was this provision of Pennsylvania law that said women had to inform their husbands before they had an abortion. Didn't have to get their permission, but had to inform them. One justice on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals upheld that provision, or wanted to uphold that provision, and that was Samuel Alito. The poetic difference, I think, is, you know, we journalists love this stuff.
Of course.
You know, that you know, the defining opinion of her career was reversing her successor. But, you know, elections have consequences.
What do you make of the fact that a majority of the court are Catholics?
Not much.
Not much. I was curious about that.
I think, you know, the history of the court reflects kind of the politics of the day. In the early days of the Republic, it was very important to have geographic diversity. When the country was so split up, you know, there had to be a Massachusetts justice, a California justice. No one pays any attention to that anymore. You know, for years there were two justices from Arizona, a relatively small state, you know, Rehnquist and O'Connor. No one noticed. Later, you know, when religion played a big part, and you know, there became in the 19th century a Catholic seat first, and then later with Brandeis and Cardoza, a Jewish seat. No one paid much attention to the fact that Clinton's two appointments were Jewish.
Right.
I mean, that I think is less significant. And yes, it is true there are now five Catholics on the court, but the biggest liberal in the history of the court, William Brennan, was a Catholic too. And I think the divisions in the country now are much more ideological than they are religious. And so I just don't think the Bush administration sat around saying, let's put five Catholics on the court. I don't think it made any difference to them.
Do you think, though, that the court reflects the country today, or is it too soon to tell?
Well, you know,
In terms of the divisions within the country over
certain issues. Yes, I do. I mean, I think, you know, the last line of the book is, you know, we get the Supreme Court we deserve. You know, in many respects, hey, come on, you live in a swing state here. This is...
And by that you mean whoever wins the presidency,
right,
gets
the only one thing will determine the future of the Supreme Court. Only one thing. The outcome of presidential elections. If a Democrat wins, we're going to get one kind of Supreme Court. If a Republican wins, we get another kind of Supreme Court. And, you know, that's as it should be. I mean, that's why we have presidential elections. I mean, it is true that 11 of the last 13 justices have been appointed by Republican presidents. That's, I mean, it's sort of remarkable that the court is as evenly divided as it is, and I think there are reasons for that. But I think you are kidding yourself if you believe anything but the outcome of presidential elections is going to determine, you know, what the future is.
And do you think Bush will get one more, or
no.
Do you think
not unless there's a high and a health crisis.
Right.
However, I do think that the next three vacancies will be in whatever order: Stevens, Ginsburg, and Souter. Stevens is 87, although I hasten to add his older brother, William Stevens, is still practicing law in Florida at the age of 90. Yeah,
fantastic.
He's in great shape. Justice Ginsburg is 76. Justice Souter is 70 and doesn't really like the job very much. I think the next term will those three, some or all of them, will be gone. If a Republican president appoints their replacements, Roe is gone, over, done, as is affirmative action. But you know what? It should be done. We've had presidents who are opposed to Roe v. Wade elected time after time, and that's part of why they're elected. So, I mean, I think, you know, the court is not a democratic institution, but it does reflect our democracy.
Right. But does it also reflect the personalities on the court? I mean, much of your book is about individual personalities and how also the kind of synergy between certain justices on the court and even how that plays out in certain legal decisions that they've made.
It is. And I don't want to give you the impression that the justices are robotic followers of, you know, the president who appointed them. And yes, their personal idiosyncrasies matter. And yes, they are influenced by the briefs and the oral arguments and the you know, you have a situation sometimes where two justices become very close, as Stephen Breyer and Sandra Day O'Connor did. But I think the elections matter more.
Let me quote something, and this is Justice Roberts talking about the Supreme Court, and he said, "Judges are like umpires. Umpires don't make rules, they apply them. Judges are not politicians." You write, "None of this is true."
Not a word.
Not a word.
I mean, I respect Chief Justice Roberts a great deal, but I think the Supreme Court justices are the commissioners of baseball. They are not umpires. They are making the rules. And I think Roberts would like to believe that what he's doing is narrower than it is. But come on. You know, the school districts of Louisville one of the terms that the conservative movement has stuck on liberals is, you know, judicial activism, while they engage in judicial restraint. In the democratic process of Louisville and Seattle, those school districts on their own decided, we want to engage in integration. This is important to us, and we're going to do it. And Roberts said, we are going to impose a change. We are going to say, you can't do that. Now, that may be right or wrong, but it ain't judicial restraint, and it is active. So I think those terms are actually not very helpful.
And what about the term precedent?
Well, again, precedent is there are some precedents they like, and there's precedents they don't like.
Exactly.
You know, Stephen
Breyer. Doesn't mean anything.
I don't want to overstate. I mean, yes, precedent means something. They don't overturn precedents lightly, but you know, Stephen Breyer at the end of the term, you know, gave this tremendous cry. Really, you know, for an unemotional guy and a very positive, good-natured person, a really despairing cry about how the court was abandoning precedent and how important that was. Well, you know, in 2003, when he joined the majority in overturning Bowers v. Hardwick, a decision from 1986, which said, you know, gay sodomy could be criminally, criminally punished, Breyer was only too happy to overrule precedent, and liberals loved that precedents were overturned. So, I'm more inclined toward the Thomas view on this, which is that it's better to be right than to follow precedent.
And I do want to take some questions. So if you have some questions, you can raise your hand and we'll have someone come with a microphone. I just have a quick other question for you, Jeffrey Toobin. You talk about Harriet Myers in this book and say that she might not have been as unqualified as people had said about her.
Well, she was pretty unqualified. But the point that I think is interesting about Harriet Myers is not her qualifications, is that at the moment she withdrew, it was very likely she would have been confirmed. It's the first time in American history that a nominee had withdrawn with a pretty darn good chance of confirmation.
Really? Because it seemed as if all the interviews that she had, Specter, others, being very
with the ever grouchy Arlen Specter, yes. whether he, in the customary Specter way, I've written a lot about our beloved Senator Specter, and, you know, there's often a lot of strum and drong about, oh, this is terrible, and then he winds up voting with the Republican administration anyway.
No, that's true. It's true.
See, I'm glad he has friends here. There's nothing wrong with that. The point about Myers, the interesting point about Myers, is what derailed her nomination was not her qualifications. It was the conservatives in the Republican Party decided en masse that she was not reliable enough. The remote chance that she might turn out something like David Souter meant no good. And she left. She withdrew. That's the significance of the Myers nomination.
Well, let's get some callers from the audience. And behind you, sir.
Oh, you're such a radio
callers.
Gal.
I'm sorry. Some questions from the audience. Yes, sir. Yeah. Go ahead.
Don't you want to give the phone number so they can call?
Don't get me started. Yes.
First of all, I want to say how much I appreciate not only your writing, but all of your work, and thank you for being with us tonight. When the last election took place, and actually the last two elections, my first thought after the results were in was, there goes the court. We're in really big trouble, we who believe in things like Roe v. Wade and some of the other things you mentioned. But it didn't seem to be a very important part of the discussion at the elections during the election time. And I was wondering how that can become part of that dialogue and why you think it might not have been.
The future of the Supreme Court is extremely important to certain groups of voters on the left and on the right. All of those voters, polls show, were going to vote for the Democrat or the Republican anyway. I mean, it is important to people who are already firmly aligned in one camp or the other. And the people who decide the outcome of presidential elections, the voters in the middle, have never been highly motivated by the issue of the Supreme Court. And, you know, I'm not a political consultant. I don't know how to make people care or whether they should be made to care. But that's just the fact of how the court has worked in presidential elections.
Thank you for the question. Do we just have one person on mic? Or am I missing someone?
Someone over here?
I'm sorry. You're over there. How about that gentleman in the middle? And you can just hold on to the mic and speak directly into it. There you go, sir. Right next to you.
Congress can set the number of judges that are on the Supreme Court by a majority of vote. Assuming a Democratic victory, a Democratic president, and a Democratic Congress, what do you think of raising the number of judges to 11?
Instead of 9? You'd have to change the name of this book.
And we'll resurrect Franklin Roosevelt to lead the charge. It didn't work in 1936. Yeah. It's not going to work now. No, I mean, a lot of people don't realize that the number of justices is not fixed in the Constitution. And in fact, up to the Civil War, the number fluctuated a good deal, 5, 6, 7, 8. When Andrew Johnson was president, it was a 9-justice court, and Congress hated him so much that when a justice resigned, they just cut the number of justices to 8 so he couldn't get another appointment. I think that I'm going to go out on a limb and say that your proposal has absolutely no chance of being enacted. And, you know, Franklin Roosevelt famously tried to pack the court because they were, and I think that's generally considered a blot on his reputation, and I don't think that's going to start.
Let's take another question from this other side of the room. There's a hand way. Actually, that gentleman on the, there you go. Yes,
could
go ahead,
you
sir.
Reflect on the decision on eminent domain? Did the court expect that kind of backlash?
That is such an interesting question. The Kelo decision from New London, where the court considered whether the city of New London could seize certain property by eminent domain and not give it to the government for, you know, a hospital or a school or a road, but give it to a private developer as part of an urban development plan. It is safe to say the justices were thunderstruck by how negative the reaction was. Particularly, again, those terms, judicial restraint and judicial activism. Justice Stevens, who wrote that opinion, you know, is often accused of being a judicial activist. And he has said subsequently, hey, wait a second. The community, the elected representatives, thought this was a good idea. We decided to let the community decide. But it was the conservatives who were so outraged that we didn't engage in judicial activism and stop it. So, I mean, I think that's an example of why that, how that terminology is not terribly useful. But just to answer your question, they were shocked by the reaction.
Yes, thank you for the question. Yes, we'll go to the other side. Someone way in the back. Yes, that gentleman right on the aisle there.
Thank you for your wonderful lecture and all your work. One quick comment and then my question. The quick comment is, I don't agree with you that Roosevelt's court packing plan didn't work. It did work. Owen Roberts, the famous switch in time that saved 9, is Justice Kennedy not Roberts in this century? That's not my question. My question is, how many successive Democratic administrations do we have to elect before there is any chance of having a 5-4 or 6-3 majority on the left?
Not many. Not many. I mean, but not one. It's got to be more than one. I mean, I mean, the three justices I named, you know, they're all liberal side. Okay, the next oldest justices are Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy. I don't think they're going to serve for another 10 years, both of them. I mean, you know, most justices leave before they're 80. I mean, some serve until they're 80, but most leave before then. Justice Scalia is, I would say, the second most unhappy justice on the court. He does not love being a Supreme Court justice as much as the others. Mm. I mean, a great deal of the work of the court is drudgery, you know, statutory cases that no one particularly cares about except the people immediately affected. He's not terribly interested in those cases either. I don't think he will be on the court for another 10 years. So you take those, you know, the four who are there and add Justice Scalia, things change.
So who's the most unhappy person on the court? If he's the second most.
Souter.
Souter is.
Souter.
Okay.
Souter doesn't like it. I mean, he hates Washington. He doesn't like it at all.
And doesn't like even being on the court?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think does the job out of a sense of obligation and duty, doesn't love it and doesn't like Washington, and doesn't like it.
Would rather be home reading, I guess.
Be home reading.
yes, a question. Yes, that gentleman halfway back there to the left, yes.
In the book, you talk about the Federalist Society and how the conservative Republican lawyers and judges have gotten together to make certain that the right candidates are placed before the president. Where have the Democrats been all this time?
Well, you know, I think the Federalist Society is sometimes described by Democrats in some sort of sinister way, as if it's like, you know, in the Da Vinci Code or something. And this, the Federal Society is a perfectly honorable, terrific organization, which is very open in what they do, and they hold meetings and they hold seminars, and what they decided to do was to sort of have conservatives get together and talk about how the constitutional law should evolve. Democrats in 1999, a law professor at Georgetown started something called the American Constitution Society, which has grown wildly in recent years and is very vibrant and growing and successful. The problem is there hasn't been a president interested in appointing any of them to anything. So, but I mean, if a Democrat is elected, you know, look for, and I intend to persuade my editor to let me do this, but look for, you know, the American Constitution, and you look at their board of directors, you know, a lot of them will wind up on courts of appeals, I think.
Yes, another question from the other side of the room, a gentleman against the wall, about halfway back.
Did I say, Peter Rubin is the professor who started. I should give Peter a plug.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your comments. As you look ahead in 2008, are there one or two cases that you think will be critical in terms of their decisions, and could they have an impact on the presidential politics of 2008?
Well, I think there are a bunch of critical cases. Even the Casey decision in 1992 didn't have that big an impact on the presidential race. I think they are just too attenuated. There's going to be a big gun control case about whether the Second Amendment bans gun control. There's going to be another big Guantanamo case. They took two big cases, I think it was yesterday, the case about the voter ID, whether that is a form of discrimination, and the method of execution case, is the lethal injection cruel and unusual punishment. So I don't think it'll be as big a year as last year, but I think it'll be an important year, because there's no such thing as an unimportant year.
Sure, sure. Yes, another question from, yes, this gentleman right here.
I'm just wondering, given how outcome determined the court's decisions have been during the Roberts Court, should those who cover the court be treating the court as though they engage in judicial interpretation and legal interpretation, as opposed to being nine political actors making political decisions?
You know, I don't want to overstate how political they are, your comment has its place analytically, but you know, if you are Linda Greenhouse or covering it for the New York Times, you can't write column, you can't cover the court that way. And, you know, it's for, I suppose, people like me, you know, writing at book length about the court to try to show the interplay of law and politics.
Okay. Yes. Another question all the way in the back there against the wall. Yes, sir.
I was very intrigued by your comment, which I agree with, that if you change the political presidential people, that changes the court. Because it seems what follows from that, there are certain decisions, certain so-called constitutional principles that really aren't to be found in the Constitution, that they're sort of what the court thinks is a good idea. And even though, for example, I'm in favor of limiting the death penalty or Roe versus Wade, I submit that as an intellectual proposition, they don't have a constitutional basis. And I remember one time Justice Ginsburg was interviewed in her first death penalty case, and she said she agonized over it. And then she decided that, I guess it probably should be left to the states and the federal government to make a determination. And I said, yeah, maybe they should. And so that's sort of what happens, I think, if you say, well, where politics go, there are some areas where there isn't a constitutional principle to apply. Is that what you're saying?
The risk of a liberal Supreme Court jurisprudence is that you turn the Constitution into a meaningless document that you can simply interpret to do whatever you want. And that if, you know, you think it's a good idea that the society should move in one direction, you should say that due process of law means anything you want it to mean. You know, I don't want to overstate my belief that the Constitution is malleable beyond and I don't think any justice believes that. But I also don't think that it's as obvious, perhaps, as you do, that you know, just because the Constitution doesn't say right to privacy, that a right to privacy doesn't exist. I mean, I think the task of interpretation involves interpreting and not just reading the words as they were written in 1787.
Yes, let's see if we have time for one or two more questions. A woman right on the aisle there, yes.
Mr. Toobin, what was the reaction of the other eight justices when the newest member of the court was appointed to be the Chief Justice?
You know, the justices, I think, are very, you know, the relationships among the justices are very cordial and polite and correct and not especially warm. I think most people are surprised at how little time they spend with each other outside of the outside of you know, work. They don't spend much time in each other's offices. They don't socialize a great deal together. And I think there was not an obvious inside candidate. Justice Scalia was a possibility, but you know, he was 70 years old. Why should, I mean, how long could he serve? Much better for George W. Bush to pick someone who would serve a long time. So, I mean, and especially Roberts was very familiar to the justices. He'd argued 39 cases, you know, very successfully. So, I think they were fine with him.
We have a question right in the front row there. Yes. Yes, sir. There's the microphone right. There you go.
I'm wondering what you think the fallout from Bush Gore in 2000 is, both in terms of how the court sees the way the society looks at the court in terms of any loss of credibility, and also if there's any fallout amongst the justices for how that played out.
Well, you know, I think the court is used to disagreeing with each other. Although that was a tough one, and as I say, Souter had the most extreme reaction. I think the fact that the court moved to the left afterwards and liberals started winning a few cases here and there softened the blow a little bit. I also think that 9/11 happened, mm-hmm. and you know, Bush v. Gore just kind of disappeared as an issue. Mm-hmm. And I think that was true at the Supreme Court as well. Can I ask myself a question?
Yes, you can.
Jeff, if Hillary Clinton is elected president, who will she put on the Supreme Court? I want to get it out there that I was first to say this. Barack Obama.
I've heard this theory. Now,
yes.
Now spin this out for us.
No, it's like it's total Clintonian Machiavellian genius. Because president of the Harvard Law Review, constitutional law professor at University of Chicago, first African American on the court since Clarence Thomas, third ever, only you know in his late 40s, and it gets rid of him.
I was going to say, and then no threat politically.
I mean. And you know, and what would he be in a position to complain? Say, oh God, she put me on the Supreme Court. Now, I actually have asked Senator Obama about this, and he gave an extremely unconvincing denial of interest. He said, "Well, I think I'd find it too sedentary." And, you know, but you know, you could see a little glimmer there. You know, constitutional law professors, they like the idea of being on the Supreme Court.
But what about a President Obama?
President Obama, I think there are a lot of more conventional choices that are possible.
Wouldn't be Hillary Clinton, though.
And I don't think it would be Hillary Clinton, although we'd love the confirmation
yeah,
hearings.
Sure.
I think the actually, speaking of which,
yes, go ahead.
Bill has been suggested as a possibility for the court.
I was wondering about that as well.
Oh, boy, that would be great. But I don't think that's going to happen. Sonia Sotomayor is a judge on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, would be the first Hispanic. Harold Koh, who's the dean of Yale Law School. Elena Kagan, who's the dean of Harvard Law School. There are lots of mm-hmm. possibilities.
Well, on that note, Jeffrey Toobin, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Oh,
Come, I'll sign books.
Oh, is that what you're going to do? Okay.
You want to tell them about? Tell them that I'll, they can buy books?
Yeah, they know that you're up. Great. Thank you, Jeffrey.
All right, it was great. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks a lot, Andy. Water. Oh, thank you. He's going to talk.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.